And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, prominent human rights lawyer, Dr. William Pepper. We're talking about his latest work, The Plot to Kill King. And, of course, we'll chat with him a little bit about the Robert F. Kennedy assassination as well and Sirhan Sirhan's case. And we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, William Pepper with us. We'll get to your calls in just a second. The case with Sirhan Sirhan, and in that particular case, you're convinced that there was another shooter involved, William, are you not?
Yes, yes, there's no question about that.
Where was that person stationed?
The person who killed Bob Kennedy was behind him and knelt down just behind him and fired. Bob was hit with four bullets at powder burn range from the rear, and they were fired in an upward angle. And the last one, the last bullet, entered his head and his brain from behind the ear, about an inch from behind him. Sirhan was never closer than about 5-6 feet to Bob Kennedy in front of him, always in front. Sirhan had been conditioned. There was more than a small amount of mind control operations that was conducted on him over a period of 2 weeks, and his role was simply when he was pinched by his handler on the neck, his role was to jump down from the steam table, stand up with a gun, and distract everyone. By shooting in front of Bob Kennedy. He got off two shots, and then his hand was pinned to the steam table, and he kept pulling the trigger for six more shots, but the bullets went all over the place. There's absolutely no doubt at all that the powder burn shots that killed Bob were fired from behind and below, and Sirhan was a distraction. Up in front, and he only got off two bullets before they jumped on him and controlled his shooting arm.
And was he like a Manchurian candidate?
Well, he was like a Manchurian candidate in the sense that there was mind control operations that were performed on him both through hypnosis, a combination of hypnosis and chemicals. So he wasn't a Manchurian candidate in the sense that he was expected to be the assassin. The assassin was a pro who was there precisely for the purpose of taking advantage of all of the disruption and the chaos that resulted from Sirhan's role as a distractor. So that's what his role was.
And why take out Bobby? Because he was too close to John F. Kennedy? Same kind
Bob,
of views?
Bob, no. Bob was going to... this is the classic reason for political assassinations. They couldn't. Bob had won the California primary. He was on his way to getting the nomination and becoming president.
He would have beaten Nixon, no doubt.
Oh, he was going to be president, but and he was pretty clear that he was going to reopen the investigation of the assassination of his brother. He had said that he was going to. Eliminate the oil depletion allowance, which is going to cost the oil companies and their bankers millions of dollars. Bob Kennedy was going to end the war in Vietnam. He was going to take all of these positions that were simply totally unacceptable to the powerful ruling forces of the society.
Do you think he would have still gone after Castro, or do you think he had given up on that?
No. I think he would definitely not have gone after Castro. He definitely shared his brother's late view that Fidel Castro and the Cuban regime should have engaged in negotiations with the United States and leading to the normalization of relations there. That whole Cold War mentality that led to the early antipathy toward Fidel had gone away, and it had gone away when Jack Kennedy was killed.
Well, let's go to the phones now. Jenny in Seattle, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Jenny. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Pepper. I'm so grateful you're on the show tonight talking about this, and I can't wait to read your book and the other two. I'd like to know if you have any ideas about what happened to John Jr., because I always felt that he was assassinated as well.
Well, Jenny, first of all, thank you for calling in, and it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I have an enormous respect for Seattle as a city, as a place where that embodies some of the true values of America, one of the few places left, I might say. So I congratulate you on living in and working in that city. In terms of John Jr., I can only say I don't know. There are some suspicious elements of the of his death, like the plane all of a sudden just plummeted, as you probably know much or more than I do about that case. But the plane just lost altitude very rapidly and plummeted at one point in time, indicating that there may have been some electromagnetic interference with the aircraft. But I don't know. I do understand that John, as we used to call him, was going to run for the Senate in New York, and that he was going to become involved in politics, and that he always had a concern about what happened to his father as he grew. So you're right to be suspicious. I think some others may have done some more serious work on that case, that and maybe a different picture will unfold.
Now, when you attempt to get a new trial for Sirhan Sirhan, what grounds are you aiming for?
Well, the major reason that Sirhan should have should be given at least an evidentiary hearing and preferably a new trial is the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. He had totally inadequate legal representation. His lawyer started off by telling the jury, "We're not here to ask you to to acquit this man. We believe he's guilty.
Oh my God!
We believe he should not be out on the streets, and we're only going to ask you to save his life. We're not going to ask you to acquit him. We share the prosecution's opinion." I mean, this was the style of the defense counsel.
But Sirhan went along with that, though. Sirhan did.
Well,
I would have yanked the lawyer.
The problem is, it's easy for us to say, well, how can a guy allow this to happen? But when you're in a very closed, isolated situation, and you're only hearing one set of opinions and advice, and you don't have any dissent, and your lawyer tells you, our job is to save your life. They've got you on this. They're gonna execute you. We got to save your life, so you've got to let us do everything we have to do to save your life. I mean, that is weighs very heavily on a defendant in the circumstances that Sirhan found himself.
How was his English then? How is it now?
Oh, his English is fine.
Okay.
He's fine. He's very bright. And very aware and very, very alert.
How often are you in touch with him now, William?
Well, my last physical contact with him was a parole hearing earlier this year, where, of course, he was denied parole. But the interesting thing at that hearing was Paul Schrade, who was United Auto Workers representative to Bob Kennedy in the Kennedy campaign. Paul came for the first time to this hearing. He had actually been with Bob and had been wounded on the night of the killing, and he just came. He's done research over many years on this. Paul's 91 years old now.
Jeez.
And he's totally showed up and was convinced that Sirhan should be granted parole, and spoke out in favor of parole. Which, of course, they're not going to do. They're determined that he will die in prison.
What would he do if they let him go? Where would he go?
He would probably go back to Jordan. He would probably go.
He would go there. He would go
yeah,
there.
That's where he has family.
Has he reacted? I'm just curious. Has he reacted to world events lately, or reacted to ISIS? Or I'm just curious what he thinks of what's happening around this planet these days.
Well, I mean, I think he has. He's shocked, and he has despair for a lot of the problems that have come upon his people. Remember, Sirhan is Palestinian, but
yes.
he's not Muslim. He's been the mass media have tried to portray him as the first
was Christian.
Islamic terrorist, but he's not even Muslim. He comes from a Christian family.
Yeah. As many people in the Middle East do.
Yes. Yes, and he's in despair as to what's happening to the Palestinians, particularly with the, you know, with their removal in the West Bank by Israel, and it's a very sad situation.
Oh, there's no question that we as a planet should be doing something for the Palestinian people,
yeah.
rebuilding
yeah,
Gaza and everything else, and giving them some hope and something that they can look forward to.
Yes. Yes.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Joe, welcome to the program. You are
George,
on the air.
How are you, George?
Good, Joey.
I'd like to ask Dr. Pepper if he has any idea who the actual shooter of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was, and the chief of surgery. Do you know what his name is?
I know the names of both of them. The shooter of Martin King is alive. I had lunch with him.
Was he a former Memphis police officer?
Yes, he was. He's a former Memphis police
does
officer.
Does he admit this?
Oh, no, but one of my researchers on the ground, who's known him for 30 years, he drives a cab now in Memphis, jumped in the back of his cab and said, gee, said, Frank, what's going on? I understand that Pepper's got a lot of new information and evidence, and that they may be coming after you. And
he was nervous, wasn't he?
He was caught off guard, and he said, "We're coming after me. What are they going to come after me for something I did 30 years ago?"
Something I did 30 years ago.
Yeah, then he said, or something I knew about.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So
as far as the doctor in the hospital, of course, no names given. Is he still alive?
No, he's dead, and I name all these people in the book, and I describe the luncheon meeting with the shooter, and he refused to eat lunch, but he came and sat down with me and over lunch. The doctor was the chief of surgery. His name was Breen, B-R-E-E-N, Bland, B-L-A-N-D. Dr. Breen Bland, and what's coincidental about him is he was also the family doctor for the Dixie Mafia family, the Adkins family, who were responsible for coordinating things on the ground in Memphis.
Wow.
And worked very closely with the Memphis mayor and the chief of the director of police and fire. So Dr. Bland sat in on a meeting and I have one of the key witnesses of a lot of information that I have in detail, and I mean detail, in this book, The Plot to Kill King. One of the sons of the of Russell Adkins, who sat in on a lot of these meetings, heard the doctor say, you just make sure if he's not killed when he's shot, just be sure you get him to my hospital, St. Joseph's.
Gosh.
We'll make sure that...
Would he have died regardless, in your opinion, based on the wounds he had?
I believe he probably would have died ultimately from his wounds. And I've had a forensic pathologist review I've actually had two look at it. And I think the opinion is that ultimately he probably would have died. The spine was nicked by that shot.
Yeah.
But they had no way of knowing that. Even the pathologist said, but they had no way of knowing that. He was still breathing in the hospital, and he was still alive. And they had no way of knowing whether he was going to survive or not.
Did you have Cyril Wecht look at any of this, the pathologist?
He was the number one guy I used. Yes. He's Cyril great. And I go back a long way. I have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah. He's one of the best. Let's go to Gene in Atlanta, Georgia. First time caller. Gene, you're on with William Pepper. Go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Pepper. George, good evening. Or
hi there.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us.
I was in TV news in Atlanta during that period, and I did an interview with Dr. King at one point, and at that particular point, Stokely Carmichael was attacking him for being an Uncle Tom, and a number of others were giving him a hard time. And he, in the interview, said, well, you know, we need to have a summit. We need to get straight among ourselves here. Then the FBI had actually wiretapped him and had him talking to his girlfriends. I have a theory that is slightly different from yours. I think J. Edgar Hoover sent a representative and said, look, we're going to totally ruin you if you don't go along with the plan, and we want you to walk out on the balcony at 6 o'clock. I think that's how it happened, because if you look at it, or if you listen and look at the video of Dr. King's speech to the sanitation workers, he says, I've seen the other side. I mean, it's as if the man knew he was going to die. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think Martin always knew that he probably was going to have a limited life. And his speech the night before at the temple, Mason Temple, is the one you're referring to. And it was a very impassioned, moving speech. That was his last speech. And there's no question that he knew that ultimately he was likely to be taken out. He did not walk out on the balcony deliberately and stand and get shot. Hoover did try to intimidate him and did send a package to him that he reviewed with Coretta and Andy Young and others, and they tried to, they effectively were trying to goad him into committing suicide. So you're right about that. But it didn't work. He was determined to lead that march, that last march in Memphis, for the sanitation workers. They got him to Memphis by killing one of the sanitation workers. And that dramatized the plight of those poor workers, and that made it necessary for him to go. But he was prepared to lead that final march and then go on into Mississippi and start from Mississippi the trek into Washington with the 500,000 people that I mentioned earlier. He was determined to lead that group into Washington and to confront elected representatives and try to change the budget and the budgetary priorities. He was called out on the balcony by Reverend Billy Kiles. Kiles was a part of the plot and was paid. And he was to have dinner at Kyle's home, a barbecue. His whole group was going to have dinner there. And so Kyle's, who insisted he was in the room with King the last half hour of his life, never was in the room with him, but knocked on the door, and his job was to get King out on the
balcony. Get him on the balcony. I always, William, suspected something strange there. Again, there are no coincidences. King goes out on the balcony. The assassins right across the courtyard in another room looking at the balcony. I mean, that just doesn't happen. That was planned. You're right. We'll be back with final calls next. Well, next hour, Robert Hastings joins us with his incredible research about UFOs and nuke sites. It's amazing. We're going to come back with William Pepper in a moment and take final calls as we talk about his book, The Plot to Kill King. And by the way, now that we've wrapped up our St. Louis event, it went just splendidly, thanks to our affiliate, of course, News Talk 97.1. They just did a great job, great job. Tom Danheiser, executive, produced it. Superb job there. But now we move on to Asheville, North Carolina, Saturday, August 27th. Another full-fledged event, so come on out. Full information right there on the homepage at the highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. William Pepper with us, our final segment. We'll get to your calls as well. What drives you, William? You don't give up. You just keep going.
Well, George, in terms of the King case, it was really a slippery slope, and I didn't intend to devote so much of the of a life to getting the details of how he was killed and why he was killed. But the more I got into it, and the more information that came to me, the more I realized I just had to follow it through. I owed it to Martin,
sure,
and his legacy, and indeed to this country, because he was taken from us at a very critical point in time.
Would he ever have run for political office?
Yes, he was interested in doing that only for the purpose of opposing the war and using a political campaign with Dr. Benjamin Spock, as I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm, for the purpose of opposing the war. And that was the only reason that he would have run for office.
Okay, let's go to the final calls. We've got Charles in Baltimore, Maryland. Charles, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, and thank you very much for allowing me on, you two. Okay, I'd like to know, what would race relations be like about, you know, if Martin Luther King was still alive? I want to make some observations here, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead, please.
In 1958 and 1968, in 1968, he was getting very, very angry, very, very impatient. And I can understand that looking out through his eyes based on something in my situation. And I don't want to digress here, but let me draw a picture for you. The National Federation of the Blind, which I'm helping, we're trying to put an end to the travesty of paying people less than the minimum wage who are blind in sheltered workshops based on the idea of being blind alone. And that's there's a terrible thing up there, which is Section 14C on the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is a lie. It says that blind people are not able to produce. Well, that's a lie. And my life's been screwed because of it. So, you know, go ahead. I guess I've talked enough.
Well, no. I wanted you to tie that into Dr. King.
Yeah. You know, like there are travesties all over the place. And, like, what would Dr. King also feel about disability? I know nobody's talked about it then, and it's just coming into vogue now.
I don't know if he really touched on those issues, William. Did he?
He had become increasingly Charles is right in the sense that he was increasingly impatient and discontent about the growing economic disparity in the United States. He saw the economic problems as being an enormous setbacks, not just for black people, but poor whites as well. And so he was going beyond just civil rights. He was now increasingly into human rights and what was necessary for a human being to have a decent life in the society. He was concerned about the absence of universal health care, as we even to this day are concerned about that. And the reason he wanted to bring this mass of humanity to Washington was to make the point that there had to be a reorientation of the values of the federal government in terms of the expenditure of monies on human programs and social programs. Those funds were going into the war effort. He had no sympathy at all, no understanding, as did many people, no understanding of why we were at war with this Southeast Asian country. What were they doing to us? What were they threatening us about? What was that all about? So he had no sympathy at all for the wars. And today he would have been horrified. He would have been horrified that what we have done in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, and particularly in Libya. He would have been absolutely horrified by this kind of regime change orientation that has taken over the military-industrial rulings of this country.
His passivity, would that work today, or do you have to be a little more violent to get things done?
Well, you know, he was being pushed in the direction of understanding the use of violence, But he had had some good conversations with Malcolm X before Malcolm was killed. Remember, Malcolm was killed in 65.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And he had some conversations with Malcolm. He understood, Malcolm helped him to understand the problems of the of deprivation and poverty in the urban north. And when he went into Chicago in Cicero, Illinois, Martin got a first-hand experience of the antipathy and the problems there, which were quite different in many ways than the rural South. So you're asking a very important question: would nonviolence have worked? I believe that he was committed to nonviolence, and I believe there are two roads to power: money and numbers. And if he had the numbers of people who were prepared to shut down the functioning of the government, yes, I think it would have worked. I definitely think nonviolence would have worked. But you needed the numbers to do it. And he was a unifier. He was a person who could bring those numbers together. And that was the threat. That's why they really had to get rid of him.
Let's go to Andy in Los Angeles now. Andy, take it away.
All right, great show, George.
Thanks, Andy.
Yes, two things. Number one, when I was a kid, and I'm 68 now, I saw Dr. King being interviewed on television by Irv Kupcinet, a late-night talk show host.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good one.
And it was a very, very compelling interview in which Dr. King was asked, aren't you afraid that, you know, something could happen to you if you continue these marches, you know? And Dr. King said very, very straightforwardly, he said, I know I'm going to get assassinated. And I got scared as a kid when I heard that. Like, he knew he was going to die, but he said he had to continue on. This was his mission on Earth. Secondly, isn't it quite interesting, George and Dr. Pepper, that 1 month before John F. Kennedy Jr. was about to have an expose in his magazine called George about the truth, what really happened to his father, President Kennedy, 1 month before, suddenly his plane dropped out of the sky.
I know, it's
and,
weird.
Unlike the story that we have been told and spoon-fed by the establishment, the conditions were very good for flying. They were not impaired whatsoever. So I'm like Georgia Nori. I don't believe in accidents or coincidences. The synchronicity, the timing of his death is very, very suspect in light of the fact that the magazine article was going to expose the possible truth about what really happened to his father. And I appreciate the show, George, and keep up the great work.
You got it, Andy. Well, he's got some good points there, William. And I'm convinced that John Kennedy Jr., if he wanted to, could have run for political office. What do you think, William?
I think he was, I understand he was heading in that direction and was thinking of running for the Senate in New York, yes.
And they did not need that, so who knows. Dennis in Spokane, Washington, you're up with us. Dennis, go ahead.
Yes, yes. Oh, you mentioned two great men, John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. What their movement was doing, the reason why they killed Kennedy was because of Camelot. Do you understand what Camelot is?
Well, we knew it in terms of the kingdom, but explain a little bit more.
Okay. Kennedy saw the money, and he was a rich man. He didn't need any. So he envisioned a government that take care of the people through tax dollars. Free health care, free schooling, and a good economy and a good life.
Sounds a little like Bernie Sanders' campaign, but I know where you're headed. I'm not sure that's the reason they got rid of Kennedy. By the way, as we approach November in a couple months, I can't believe how fast this year's going, William. It's unbelievable. We'll have some experts on talking about the JFK assassination. I'm convinced Kennedy was not killed by a lone gunman. It's the same formula that they use all the time, William. They get the patsy, and that covers up the conspiracy.
Yes, yes. You have to, if you, as I mentioned earlier, if you put these in a historical context, you understand that throughout history, and I'm meaning this going back to Socrates and Julius Caesar, and then moving all the way forward, and I can go through any number of the political victims who have been assassinated, and all the way down to the present. you can see that there's a pattern. They influence history by taking out a key leader. If they cannot in any other way intimidate, corrupt, or in some ways co-opt him,
yep,
into the fold. Yep.
If he doesn't play ball, he's in
That's
trouble.
Right. If he doesn't play ball, and if he's has a critical following and can affect the power structure of the society, assassination is the last resort.
I mean, this country is a war machine. It makes its money on weaponry, and corporations make its money on weaponry. If you had a president who said, "That's it, folks, no more wars, we're done with that, we're going to stop all this stuff, we're pulling out of all these countries," something would happen to him.
Well, Jack Kennedy, as you know, was pulling out of Vietnam.
Yeah.
He had already given the instructions to remove the first group. They were to come out in December of 1963. When they killed him in November of 1963, Lyndon Johnson reversed that order and then began the buildup of the forces to the point where we had over 500,000 people.
You know, what's interesting, when I was reading a book by Seymour Hersh called The Dark Side of Camelot about the Kennedys, and you know, on one hand, you look at all the amazing things he did or tried to do as president, and then you have to look at his personal side of his life. Well, that guy was out of control in the White House. I mean, he dabbled with just about anything that moved. It was interesting how he was able to balance a presidency like that.
Well, and remember, he was a man who was not not well. It was in physical.
He had Addison's disease and a bad back.
Yeah. He was not well.
Let's go to Jan in Brooklyn, New York. Hello, Jan. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Mr. Pepper.
Hi.
With the mind control, you know, I think if they ever would let their hand out, isn't it possible you could hypnotize him and he could tell you who did that to him? And I was wondering, do you know the mind control techniques they use? And I also thought of, I'm wondering if they get mind control techniques to get the soldiers to fight, like in Iraq. And
oh, yeah, you can do that. But interesting question, William. Has Sirhan ever been hypno-regressed where maybe he is able to tell them some things?
Yes.
He has?
Yes.
Oh, what has he said?
Well, I've used Dr. Daniel Brown, who is one of the leading psychologists out of on the faculty of Harvard. And Dan had spent over 70 hours with Sirhan, and part of it is under hypnosis, and part of it is free. And he's been able to. There are certain aspects of the events that evening he's totally blocked on. They've been able to totally affect the block. He literally does not remember.
It's like gone, missing time.
It's gone. But we Dan has been able to take him back in terms of previous events and experiences that he had in life and people he met and things of that sort. We have put a good deal of this and Dan's statements in the filings that we've made before the courts. It doesn't make any difference, of course. They're not really interested in the truth about that assassination, but we have done that.
Does he have any idea why he was even there?
He was there. There were several parties going on, as you probably recall it,
right,
or may know. There were several parties going on, and he went in he was sort of motivated to go in there and to hang out, and that's where he got in the hands of this woman who was in a polka dot dress, who became effectively his controller. And he pretty much just followed her, and she pretty much just led him. She led him into the pantry, and she controlled him all of the time.
Well, he did have a gun on him, right?
Yes, he had a
pulled off a couple
gun.
Shots.
He had a gun, and he had been taking target practice at a local firing range that afternoon, and so he came from that experience into into this fatal trap that he was led into.
Pat, we've got a minute for you in Minneapolis, but go for it. Go ahead, Pat.
Have you ever heard about another test subject in the same experimental type test group or a similar one who said that she was told by one of the directors and leaders of this research, supposedly, that he said, "I am Dr. Mengele"?
Whoa.
And who, where did that come from?
That program, and I can't remember what it was called. It was kind of like a gun thing, M16 or something like that. It had a letter and one or two digits. The name of that program that Sirhan was a test subject or experimental subject, there were other subjects in those groups. And one of them, a woman, said that one day, one of the leaders or directors, an older man, told her, "I am Dr. Mengele."
That's incredible. You got to send me a little email on that, Pat. We'll share it with you, William. Who knows? Might be another book for you. William, thanks again. Let's keep in touch. Let's see what happens and develops. Love to interview Sirhan with you, if we could arrange that. But we shall see. We'll stay in touch. William Pepper, the name of the book, The Plot to Kill Kennedy. More to come on Coast to Coast AM.